Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, today our topic is, can hyperinflation happen here? What are the lessons that we can learn from Zimbabwe? Since this is a live call-in show, please call us with your questions at 1-800-313-9443. Let me repeat that for you. That's 1-800-313-9443. Folks, today we have a very important show. First, I would like to introduce our special commentator for today's show, Mr. Patrick Barron, who teaches an introduction to Austrian economics at the University of Iowa and has been a professional consultant to the banking industry for over 20 years. Welcome, Pat.
Hello. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Excellent. I'm very happy to have you here with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And now I would like to introduce our special guest. Today we are very honored to have Mr. Douglas French. Hello, Doug.
Hello, Michael.
I'm glad to hear your voice today. So, folks, Mr. French is the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He obtained his master's degree in economics while studying under Murray Rothbard and Hans Hermann Hoppe, and was, prior to this current position, employed as a banker and had a career in banking. Doug has also written extensively on banking, money, and I do recommend very highly that you visit his archives at Mises.org. Let me spell that for you. That's Mises.org. So, Doug, no discussion about the possibility of hyperinflation can ignore the central role of the Federal Reserve and its chairman, Mr. Ben Bernanke, Time Magazine's 2009 Man of the Year, who's supposedly an expert on the Great Depression, and who has famously touted the idea that printing massive amounts of new dollars is a great tool for our economy. Let's start by asking, what is basically wrong with that idea and Mr. Bernanke's approach?
Well, yeah, Mr. Bernanke actually has specialized, reportedly, in his academic career in studying the Great Depression, and it's his belief that the Federal Reserve at the time didn't go far enough, that they didn't print enough money, they didn't bail out enough banks, and because of that, the Great Depression in the 1930s was extended. And so it is his belief that now, to fix things, he has to create more and more pages of the Federal Reserve playbook, if you will, create more ways to create money to save the banking system and to support aggregate demand by way of flooding dollars into the system.
Now, I don't want to get too technical, but I recall that just prior to the crisis that came up in 2008, there were very few what were called windows through which the Federal Reserve actually created new money. And now I understand there's a couple of dozen. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think at least a couple of dozen, and he probably lays awake at night creating more. But over time, the Fed has been able to create other vehicles to push money into the system, and but it, in its most simple terms, the Fed balance sheet used to be essentially government bonds. When they wanted to inject liquidity into the banking system, they would buy government bonds from banks, and they would do that by writing a check on themselves to buy those bonds. And that money was, of course, created out of nowhere, and then the Federal Reserve would have government paper on its balance sheet.
Well, we're not going to go through the entire recap on how fiat money is created by the Federal Reserve in this show. We have other shows that focus on that. But when we come back from our break, folks, we're going to continue with this interview with Doug French and discuss similarities, the dangerous similarities of the U.S. and Zimbabwe. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Mr. Douglas French, and our topic today is, can hyperinflation happen here, and the lessons that we're going to learn from Zimbabwe. Now, Doug, you know, in one of your writings, you say that Helicopter Ben, as Mr. Bernanke is sometimes referred to, is considered the great inflator, but he's no match for a gentleman by the name of Gideon Gono. Who is Gideon Gono?
Well, Gideon Gono was the governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, and Gono started his career with the national breweries in Zimbabwe, and he went on to the Fertilizer Corporation, then went into banking, which was kind of an interesting career path. Eventually went into commercial banking, and he became Robert Mugabe's personal banker, Robert Mugabe being the head guy there in Zimbabwe. So eventually he rose to be the governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe and took over an economy that that was not very good. I mean, there's no question that he inherited a very bad situation when he took office in 2003. The inflation rate was 619%, and so things weren't very good, but he certainly made it worse.
So now in 2009, there was an award called the Ig Nobel Prize, and he won that prize.
Yeah, he won the Ig Nobel Prize, which is somewhat of a tongue-in-cheek award that's given for giving people a simple, everyday way to cope with a wide range of numbers by having his bank print notes with denominations ranging from 1 cent to $100 trillion.
On the paper, right.
Yes.
And they all had expiration dates as well.
They all had expiration dates as well, and in fact, they've all expired at this point.
You know, I would like to actually interject this quote that you alerted me to that Mr. Gono made. It's rather an incredible quote, and he made this to Newsweek in 2009, that when he was interviewed and asked if he viewed his term as the reserve, their central banking reserve governor, as a success, he responded, "I am modestly credited with the survival strategy of my country." And I find that, you know, we know that Mr. Bernanke has many friends who still sing his praises in this similar kind of way. Who comes to mind first for you?
Well, everybody seemingly, you know, sings the praises of Bernanke. I mean, all you have to do is turn on CNBC or any of the Fox Business Channel. Everybody on Wall Street praises Bernanke from bringing us back from the edge of the abyss. Gee, things would have been so much worse. And, of course, former Secretary Hank Paulson had this great quote that you know, he shuddered to wonder what the world would have been like if Ben Bernanke hadn't been on the job. You know, that we're in deep doo-doo, but we would have been in much deeper doo-doo if not for Helicopter Ben.
Well, as way of a little bit of additional background for folks, you point out that Mr. Bernanke is also considered to be a humble guy from humble beginnings, and Gono himself refers to himself as a humble guy. What does he say, and how does he actually live, though?
Well, Gono actually, he said he started out as poor. He made tea, kept house. He was a normal guy. But ultimately, while Bernanke lives a relatively relatively normal lifestyle here in the United States, Gono built a 47-room bedroom palace down the street from his boss, President Mugabe. And he's got a glass swimming pool. He's got a mini theater, landscape gardens, and the whole bit. So he's living quite an extravagant lifestyle.
I understand he also owns a number of farms that were confiscated by the Mugabe government.
Yeah, the Mugabe government really started all this.
When was that, back in the late 70s?
Late 70s and the 80s, and the government seized farms from white farm owners and friends of Mugabe, such as Gideon Gono, were given some of these farms. And in the case of one particular farm, during the dry season, they actually bring water on a 25-mile-long pipeline from a reservoir and to Gono's farm. Now, this is water that's supposed to supply the people of the capital city, Harare, and instead is just going to water Gideon Gono's crops.
So, you make the point that Mr. Gono seems to be doing a lot better than Mr. Bernanke. By the way, folks, I was not aware of this, that Mr. Bernanke makes a salary of less than $200,000 a year. But Mr. Gono is doing much better than that. But our Fed is making money. Like you say, they're printing the stuff. You know, America's Central Bank is still making an absolute lot of money.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve made more money last year than they ever have in their history. They made $52.1 billion. That's the highest ever. They made over $30 billion each of the previous 2 years, made close to $30 billion in 2006. So the Fed, creating money out of nowhere and buying assets with it and earning that interest, creates lots of money, which then they build these big expensive palaces all over the country where they stuff their economists to do all the deep thinking that goes on.
Doug, this is Pat. Isn't it true though that if the Fed were to liquidate its assets today, undoubtedly the Fed is massively insolvent because it's holding, it's booking assets at 100 cents on the dollar that are worth who knows what, maybe 10 cents on the dollar. Is that not true?
Well, that would be my view, yes. I mean, that's a great point. The Fed's balance sheet has expanded from $800 billion to $2.2 trillion during this crisis, and that expansion was paying, as you say, 100 cents on the dollar for various very dubious assets, mortgage-backed securities and the like that they took off the balance sheets of the banks that they saved. So, yes, indeed, if the Fed were liquidated, they would likely be insolvent, although they do have some fairly impressive real estate around the country.
It appears that central banking is a pretty good business to be in.
Excellent business, yeah. Vince Reinhardt.
You get the use of the money first because you make it.
You make the money and you get to spend it first, and you spend it before prices go up in response to the money you've created. It's like Vince Reinhardt told the Washington Post, you buy assets that have a nice yield and your cost of funds are low. Well, he doesn't even bring up the idea that you know, they're creating money out of nowhere to buy.
Yeah, that's about the lowest cost of funds there could be.
Yeah, if we could all do this in our basements, wouldn't that stimulate the local economy?
Doug, this is Pat again. That does bring up an interesting point that I asked my class and anyone who thinks the Fed is doing such a wonderful job. In fact, I asked this in Michael's presence at a meeting of the Fed, when they were touring the country on a public relations campaign. I said, how does the Fed differ from just an ordinary counterfeiter?
Well, they don't at all. And I remember in class, Murray Rothbard used to have this cartoon that he pulled. I can't remember from what the magazine was, but it had two guys in front of a printing press, and they were making some dollar bills, and one of them quipped, boy, the local neighborhood sure is going to get a stimulus, you know. And the government, if you want to land yourself in jail for sure, the government will come and get you if you get in the counterfeiting business because they do not like the competition.
I think that's exactly right. They want to be the sole counterfeiter that, well, Mises and Rothbard have both said, you know, if we all could counterfeit money, then we would quickly add as many zeros at the end of our printing press dollars that we needed to, and everyone would see how ridiculous this is. But if you are the only counterfeiter and people are forced to use your money, it's a great gig.
Absolutely is. The cost of making a dollar bill or a $100 bill is somewhere between 0 and 4 cents, I'm told, and so the spread between those two numbers is extraordinarily high.
And that, that, by the way, only accounts for about 4 to 5% of the entire money supply.
Sure, the rest of it is now just creating digits and
right. You got a keyboard with enough paint still left on your zero key. You can make an awful lot of zeros very quickly.
That's exactly right.
Doug, doesn't it seems to me that what everyone seems to ignore is that money serves a purpose in this world, and its purpose is as exchange. But to understand exchange, you have to understand how money comes into existence. Maybe we can talk about that after the break.
Yeah, I think that'd be a very good thing for us to discuss when we get back. So, folks, we're going to take a brief break, and so please stay with us. This is Michael McKay, Radio Free Market. My guest, Mr. Doug French, and special commentator Patrick Barron, and we'll be back in just a minute. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay. And Pat, just before the break, you were asking Doug a question. Please go ahead.
Yes, Doug. My comment was that I think a lot of people really just do not understand what money is and what purpose it serves. And to understand that, you really have to understand how money comes into existence. I wonder if you could discuss that.
Well, money comes into existence through the marketplace. I mean, I think a lot of students unfortunately get taught that what is money? Well, it's whatever the government says it is. Well, that's not necessarily true because government couldn't just print up pieces of paper with numbers on them and have people expect to trade those any more than if I created Doug French notes and tried to pass them off for a sandwich at the local deli. Money started originally with barter, and over time, because of the double coincidence of wants, two things began to emerge as money historically, and that has been gold and silver. And eventually, governments initially they backed paper money with that gold and silver, knowing that that's what the market preferred. But then eventually, governments cut the ties to gold and silver, and now we're in this fiat world that we're stuck with.
So I want to backtrack a little bit with you, Doug. You had mentioned earlier that when Mr. Gono took office in 2003, the stats on how Zimbabwe was doing in terms of its inflation, which was pretty bad at that particular time.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was 619%. Yeah.
And yet at that particular time, he was blaming other people for causing this to be the case. And yet by the end of 2008, it was much, 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 much worse.
Yeah, he wanted to blame everybody for the inflation rate in his country, and the inflation rate by the end of 2008 was 231 million%.
So it went from 619% to 231 million% in that 5-year period of time.
That's correct, and at the time, that would mean that a policeman inspector's Christmas bonus that year was equivalent to 1 American cent on the black market. So, Gono had made things considerably worse, but he didn't tend to. I mean, he said that it was it was the weather's fault, that they hadn't had enough rain, that there was a drought that was more prevalent in Zimbabwe than it had been in previous years. He blamed other countries for trade sanctions. He blamed the United Kingdom.
Well, how do the people in Zimbabwe feel about this guy?
Well, they hated the guy. They were throwing rocks at the building and protesting, and because of their money wasn't worth anything, and it was a situation that as they printed more and more money, then even as much as they printed, it became scarce. People would wait in line for money at the bank. They couldn't get any. And so they focused their hatred on him, as
they
should
have. Did he take any responsibility for this?
No, of course. It wasn't, it wasn't his fault. He said that he had the finest minds in Zimbabwe, that, they were going to print money to build dams and buy irrigation equipment, that he was going to lead a new agricultural revolution through the greatness of the people and his ability to print money.
So how about Mr. Bernanke? Does he feel like he has anything to do with inflation?
No, he's the same way. I mean, he believes he was interviewed by 60 Minutes last year, and he says that the Fed's an institution that most people don't know anything about, and that that one of the main tools is to manage the monetary policy of the United States and to stabilize our country or our economy and keep prices stable.
I think Murray Rothbard had a quip about that. He referred to that as there was a robber syndrome.
I remember him saying this in class, and of course it's in a wonderful little book he wrote called The Case Against the Fed. Murray wrote, "The culprit solely responsible for inflation, the Federal Reserve, is continually engaged in raising a hue and cry about inflation for which virtually everyone else in society seems to be responsible. What we are seeing is the old ploy by the robber who starts shouting, 'Stop, thief,' and runs down the street pointing ahead of others."
Yeah.
So it's always everyone else's fault, according to the central bankers.
Right.
Well,
and Bernanke,
they're still engaged in that today. I mean, one of the things that just disgusts me are these hearings in Washington where we're seeking culprits for the financial crisis that we have by dragging in Wall Street bankers and people who are selling homes. Everybody but
the parents themselves. Yep, exactly that. So, folks, we're going to talk more about these so-called culprits and the other ways that the Federal Reserve does not take responsibility for its causal actions right after the break. This is Radio Free Market. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. With me, Doug French of the Mises Institute, Mr. Patrick Barron at the University of Iowa. Now, Doug, we were just talking about over the break how Mr. Gono and Mr. Bernanke ignore the fundamental role of the real engine of prosperity, which are savings and the property rights that we have related to our savings. And they think they can just print money print their way to prosperity. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean that's the interesting thing about central bankers. It's like their economics training is deficient in that they don't realize that it is capital accumulation. It is people saving money, delaying consumption, and the delay of that consumption creates savings, and that savings is what is used to expand an economy. These two gentlemen believe that they can just print it. And in the case of Gono, he said, You know, we're printing money to build dams and buy irrigation equipment, and that, you know, they think they can print infrastructure. And,
you know, going back to our show that we had with you a month or so ago, when we talked about hooray for deflation and the history lessons of the late 1800s, it struck me as I was listening to that show again recently that in a more stable monetary system, people are more likely incentivized to save, because if they know that the money is at least going to be worth and have the purchasing power that it has today, 5 years from now, then they can make those longer-term savings kinds of plans. But in a planned inflationary economy, such as what we have lived under since the Federal Reserve was formed, the incentive is exactly the opposite. The incentive is actually to spend the money before it is worth less. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only rational thing to do, if you know the government is destroying your property, destroying your money, every day, all day, then you're going to trade that money for real goods as quickly as you can. And so you don't have any capital accumulation. And that's what's been so tragic about the case in Zimbabwe, where they took an amazingly rich country,
one of the most prosperous countries in Africa.
Yeah, the breadbasket of Africa, an extraordinary country in terms of not only the their natural resources, but their literacy rate amongst their population. Incredibly rich soil, just a wonderful country, very blessed. And
well, they had 80% of the world's platinum deposits.
Exactly, yeah. And yet they exported to most all the region. And after this debacle of printing money, thinking that he could print prosperity, now they most of the people in Zimbabwe have had to subsist on government aid from other countries. So now, instead of being a exporter to the region, they're essentially having to take handouts.
Yeah, and so you know you make the point here that Mr. Gono was kind of an uber Keynesian, but you know, it's the same as President Obama. You know, to build infrastructure as a springboard for economic success just doesn't work.
Well, actually, Gono makes has been quoted numerous times to say, look, what I've done has been done successfully in other countries throughout the world. People have put me down, he says, but look at America, look at other parts of the world, look at Europe. Every country has to depend on their central bank. He said, therefore, printing money to sustain lives, to build infrastructure and springboard from which to leap forward cannot be bad. And that's essentially what we've done in the United States here with the bailing out Wall Street, bailing out Detroit, bailing out, banks and it's really off the same playbook.
Yeah, Doug, this is Pat again. I have read the same supporters of those policies writing in the editorial pages of the New York Times that this is the right thing to do. In fact, I have read on the editorial pages of the New York Times that the United States should consider putting expiration dates on its money so that we silly people, foolish people, do not hoard our money for an uncertain future. We must get out there and spend. And the biggest cheerleader for this is Paul Krugman, mm-hmm. our latest Nobel laureate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what a year when you have Paul Krugman winning the Nobel Prize and Ben Bernanke as the Man of the Year. I mean, certainly a low in terms of economic knowledge. And this idea of putting expiration dates on notes as they did in Zimbabwe, and the idea of putting that into play in America. I know Japan has had thoughts of instituting that policy as well, because and the belief here is that 0% interest rates is too high. The thought is that you need negative interest rates. Well, how could you have negative interest rates? Well, you put an expiration date on the money and force people to spend it. And those are the kind of wacky policies that we have that will absolutely cut off spending or saving, and will cut off capital formation, and will cut off future prosperity if they're allowed to be instituted.
I think the important thing, we're probably, this is probably beyond this segment or this week's radio show that Michael has, but how the whole idea of what money is and how it's been perverted by central banks leads into the concept of the Austrian business cycle and why we have business cycles and what those really mean. I think the Austrians really understand this, whereas the Keynesians have no concept of what a business cycle is. They don't have any idea.
Yeah, to Keynesians, this is all a lack of aggregate demand, and for.
Would you explain that term?
Well, when I mean aggregate demand, they view a recession or a depression as a lack of people spending their money. Well, people are doing the logical thing after a boom. They're deleveraging. They're saving their money. And they're accumulating capital, and that's what people should be doing. This is the healing process that we have going on now. The government's doing all they can to interrupt that process by these stimulus programs, by central banks creating money. People are trying to do the right thing, and the government's doing the wrong thing by offering incentives to buy homes, doing cash for clunkers, and there's even talk of another stimulus plan, and if the market continues to crash over the next few weeks, who knows what kind of policy they may.
There was a new one that was announced. It's called Cash for Caulkers. That's the home energy bill, $6 billion in incentives for people to, get out the old caulking gun.
Right.
And so they'll
we don't know
food.
Enough. We're not smart enough to do that ourselves, Michael. Don't you know?
Yeah.
But Pat, this is an open question to both of you. How do the Zimbabwe business people view this?
Well, I know from the quotes that I found from business people in Zimbabwe, the uncertainty of inflation essentially just drove them out of business. And that's why at the end there were very few services available. The cupboards were bare at local stores. Business people just couldn't survive in that kind of environment where they buy goods at one price and the prices would go up so much the next day or the next few hours that there's no way they could plan their business. And it goes back to the point you made earlier. When you have a stable monetary instrument, if you had gold or silver, you know what it's going to be worth next week, next month, next decade. People can plan and they can save and they can create goods and services with knowledge that the yardstick will, a foot will remain 12 inches. But, when all those metrics changes over time because the government is perverting the monetary instruments, then that uncertainty just drives people from business.
So, Doug, let me ask you this. Is America past the point of no return?
Well, some people think so, and it's interesting when we see what's going on in Greece, and I don't think people were really very cognizant of what some of the metrics like external debt to GDP ratios and that kind of thing, but Professor Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart, they have a new book out about booms and busts and crises, and they say that when external debt passes 73% of GDP or 239% of exports, the result is default, hyperinflation, or both. And according to IMF data, the United States has already gone too far. Our external debt to GDP is 96%, and our debt to exports is 748%.
You know, I'd like to, I don't normally like to do this, but I'd like to ask if you could repeat those numbers slowly for the folks at home, because that's pretty shocking.
Yeah, the Rogoff and Reinhart benchmark is 73%. When external debt, the country's external debt, passes 73% of GDP or 239% of exports, the result is default or hyperinflation or both, and the United States is well beyond that. Our debt to GDP ratio is 96%, and our debt to exports is 748%.
So, you know, in many ways, we're really in uncharted waters, and when Mr. Gono finally recognized he was in uncharted waters, what did he decide that he was going to do?
Well, he thought he had God on his side, and he did extraordinary things. And he said, to ensure that my people survive, I had to print money, is what he told Newsweek. And he found myself doing extraordinary things that aren't in the textbook. But he really looked, and while he was saying this, he said, gee, I had God on my side to vindicate me. And he said, look at what the U.S. is doing. Look what they're doing around the world. And he felt he was doing the right thing by just continuing to print money.
Now, you mentioned during the break that the Zimbabwe dollar basically has collapsed at this point. This is the postscript to this particular story we're giving ahead of time. But as recently as this speech that you gave a few weeks ago, what was the inflation rate in Zimbabwe at that particular time?
Well, it was hard to know when I wrote my piece, but I make a reference to November 14th of 2008, and a gentleman, Steve Hanke from Johns Hopkins University, has done a lot of work on Zimbabwe, and he was actually tracking the annual inflation rate in Zimbabwe. And as of November 14th, 2008, he had it at 89.7 sextillion percent. Sextillion, for those of you listening, is 10 to the 21st power. Another way to look at it is that's a daily rate of 98%. And that means prices were doubling every 24.7 hours. Imagine your life savings being cut in half
daily
in a day.
Yeah, just
that's
daily.
How devastating inflation is.
But you know, we were talking also during the break that Zimbabwe had a back door. Their black market had U.S. dollars to work with. Now, ultimately, that's what they're working with right now, right?
Ultimately, they've quit printing. Zimbabwe Bank is out of business, and they're now trading in U.S. dollars. In fact, I've received emails since my article came out that people who've been to Zimbabwe, they actually went to ATM machines and got good old American dollars, they described, out of ATM machines. There are goods returning to the shelves, but now the problem is, how good is that U.S. dollar going to be?
Well, you know, we don't have a backup. I mean, if our dollar collapsed, what would we use? Barter, gold, cigarettes, cans of tuna fish, what?
Well, a lot of those things have been used in the past, and I think that, you know, I think Mark Faber said it best once. He said everyone needs to be their own central bank, and if you're going to be your own central bank, you need to have some gold, you need to have some silver, you need to have some things you can trade. Gold and silver have traditionally been the instruments that are most marketable.
Our actual price inflation that we're getting is that is being reported by the press is quote-unquote fairly modest, but there is a website that we've referred to many times of John Williams, shadowstats.com, which I recommend everybody reading at least their homepage and reading the free reports that they have there. And they've been reporting recently that prices are really rising in the United States at 9.4%.
Michael and Doug, this is Pat. I was just telling my class just this week that I remember the day after the election in 2008. Obama had been elected, and I was in my car driving to another town to get it worked on, get my car serviced, and one of the big signs on the interstate when these big chain gas stations had gasoline at $1.69 a gallon. And I called my son and jokingly said, look, he's only been elected for one day, and already the price of gasoline is falling. It's a miracle. Well, now here in Iowa City, it's $2.77 a gallon.
Right. Well, okay, folks, we're going to wrap this show up in the next segment, and I really urge you to stick with us because we have a very important portion of the show just about to happen. We're talking with Mr. Doug French and Mr. Patrick Barron. This is Michael McKay, Radio Free Market. We'll be back right after the break. We're going to talk more about what you can do to insulate yourself and inoculate yourself. Stay with us. And welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and Doug French, we were talking a few minutes ago about the essential steps of how this kind of hyperinflation took place. And one of the very first things that we were talking about happening was when Mr. Mugabe came into power in 1980, how the one of the first things that he did was actually seizing the private property, the farmland, and redistributing it. Despite voters turning down the measure just 2 months prior to him taking those actions. Would you comment more about that, please?
Yeah, I mean, Robert Mugabe was a committed Marxist, so he believed that he didn't believe in private property rights. He believed that the government could seize whatever property it deemed that it could take and redistribute to others, and that's what he did. He took farms from productive farmers and gave it to friends of government. Of course, those farms have become quite unproductive over time and have led to the shortage that we've talked about previous in the program, where now all of a sudden these farms are not producing crops, they're not producing things that are useful for consumption. And that's what you need to inspire people, to incentivize people to build up capital is private property rights. And in addition to a sound currency, people have to be secure in the fact that the property they have won't be taken from them. So what's happened in Zimbabwe is this direct seizure of property, and then this very indirect seizure of property by way of inflation. And we see this on somewhat of a smaller scale in countries like the United States, where part of our property is seized through taxation overtly, makes people very unhappy. But then the real silent killer is when the Fed continues to print money, create money, and our property is seized from us.
I'd like to read a quote. I'd like to actually interject and read a quote from you, Doug. That you say, "No tool other than war can completely destroy an economy like inflation." I think that's a very, very powerful point.
I think that's exactly what's happened in Zimbabwe. I think they're living proof that you can take a country that was so rich in natural resources, such an the breadbasket of Africa, a huge exporter, very rich in minerals, very motivated populace who had a very, very high literacy rate, and just essentially decimate them. And you couldn't have done, you may have been able to do it quicker by dropping bombs on the country, but I don't think the devastation would be any more complete than you've had
now,
with inflation.
Obviously, people must get educated on this. You mentioned Murray Rothbard's excellent book, The Case Against the Fed. Ron Paul, of course, has written an excellent book, and the Fed. You have an excellent book. We're going to be recommending that to other people. We're going to also suggest to everyone that they share this MP3 with others, know that it can happen here, and start speaking up. Because if everyone started to laugh, even though the emperor, even the emperor would have to admit that he's been swimming naked. So, unfortunately, folks, we're coming to the end of our show. I want to thank both our special guests, Mr. Doug French, and our special commentator, Pat Barron, for being with us today. This is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market. And please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com. You can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, when we will have our exclusive interview with Dr. Ron Paul, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.